Don't you know we're talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper? Don't you know we're talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper? While they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for a promotion. Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper. Poor people gonna rise up, get their share. People gonna rise up and take what's there. Don't you know you better run, 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 run. Oh, I said you better run, 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 run. Cause finally the tables are starting to turn. Talking about the revolution.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the French Connections Thursday edition. My name is Daryl Bradford Smith. It's great to have you here with me on this Thursday, the 15th day of June. And we have a very important discussion today with a gentleman from Israel. He is a military officer in the IDF, the Israeli Defense Force. He has left his position in that force and has been actually attempting in both Bolivia and now in the United States to receive a political asylum for the threats and the fears he has about returning to Israel based on the information he's been sharing. He's an author. He's written a book. And it discusses many of the things about Israeli society that Americans may not be aware of. Much of it has to do with the way the internal passports work and how things within that society are structured. And it's quite a bit different a take than what Americans believe. And I think you're going to find this information quite telling. Further than that, there are other quite important issues that Reuven can talk to us about. And so, Reuven, I want to welcome you here. Could you possibly tell the guests your name and give us a little bio on yourself?
Hello to my listeners. My name is Reuven Schossen. I'm an Israeli citizen who has written a book called The Renegade that tells my story in that country and my final left from there. I was raised in a kibbutz in the Jordan Valley, south from the Sea of Galilee. After the early years, I was enrolled to the army, as most secular Jews are. Other segments of the country are not going to the army. This is one of the examples of discrimination between different citizens within the country. In the army, I was invited and finished successfully an officer's course. I made 4 years in the regular army, and afterwards I have been for 15 years making reserve service.
Now, what rank did you attain in the IDF?
My final rank was of captain.
Okay.
During my service, I was posted in several sensitive places. And once I left Israel, I left it with strategic information in my mind. And apparently, this is one of the reasons of my persecution. Mm-hmm. I fear very much of my speaking about certain issues.
Yeah.
I'm not referring to nuclear capacity of Israel, but to actual movement of the regular army, which cannot be changed.
Mm-hmm.
Following the years in the army, following the first 4 years in the army, I left, I went to the university. Well, I have four academical degrees, three of them in chemical physics. During the process, I published articles in several prestigious journals, including the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science of the USA, Molecular Physics, and others. And toward the end of this period, in parallel, I made an MBA, mm-hmm. a Master in Business Administration at the Heriot-Watt University from Edinburgh, which has a branch in Israel.
Okay.
Beyond that, I work with the Jacobson family, which is one of the few families running the country. I don't know if you are aware of that, but 80% of the Israeli economy is being run by less than 30 families.
Now, restate that. What part of the 30 families are controlling what exactly?
Less than 30 families are running 80% of the Israeli economy.
Okay,
I was working with the Jacobson family, which ran a big part of the chemical industry. The chemical
okay.
industry in Israel is a very big one.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the nuclear industry, because of the Dead Sea that has many minerals. And I was there in several positions, but mainly the most important one as the scientific director of the of a fund searching for new startups in Israel.
So you were a venture capital fund.
But, you know, they were trying to evade taxes as well as any other corporation. And in order to pay less taxes, they had such a fund. You know, by investing in other companies,
yeah.
you can pay less taxes to the country.
Mm-hmm.
In that position, I had access basically to all the chemical industry.
Mm-hmm.
I met maybe the main people, the main research people in all of the main industries in Israel. In that position, I have been used by an American company called the Dow Chemical. I
mm-hmm.
think you have heard about them.
Yeah.
They used me to transfer American military secrets to the state of Israel. By the way, I was approached by them.
They came to you and said, would you like to...
Actually, I have been invited to the European headquarters in Zurich, in
mm-hmm.
the little town of Olgen. It's a bit south of Zurich. And there I was instructed on the use of several chemicals they produce to improve the propulsion system of any... rockets.
Okay.
And I was instructed to approach Rafael, which is the Israeli authority in these issues, to explain them how to use that technology. That technology has been told me by them, by Dow themselves.
Now, did that technology find its way outside of Israel to other countries such as China or other India or other countries?
I cannot say.
Okay.
I can't say that in the information reached Rafael, I cannot tell you what they did with that.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know as well as I do, the Americans are supposed to have regulations that prohibit that kind of transfer of information. And you know that, right?
Yes, I know that now.
Mm-hmm. So now...
At the time, I was an Israeli citizen
mm-hmm.
approached by an American corporation that asked for me to sell the product to
yeah.
an Israeli one.
But do you think this was illegal transfer or a legal transfer? Was it illegal or legal, do you think?
Well, I tell you something. When I was at that meeting, and after I was told that this is a secret technology, secret American technology, I told the guy, why are you telling me that? Why are you telling me secrets of another country? And he told me, look, you are an Israeli, that's not your business. You are not an American citizen.
Okay. So now, what the next question I'd like to ask you is, during your time in Israel, you were in a reserve status in the military,
yes,
but you also participated in military operations during that reserve period, did you not?
Yes, actually, the event that pushed me out of Israel was 34 days in the military after the Passover of 2002. I don't know if you recall, but in the Passover evening of that year, there was an attack, a terrorist attack, in an hotel in Netanya.
Mm-hmm.
Netanya is a town a few kilometers north of Tel Aviv.
Yep.
After that event, the state of Israel decided to reoccupy all the Palestinian cities in the West Bank.
Yep.
It was a way of punish civilians for an action of a terrorist. For some strange reason, the government decided not to do the reoccupation through the regular army, but through the reserve one. And I was called for 34 days.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe this is the point to remind that I am a converted Jew. I have converted to Christianity, and I am a very active member of the Lutheran Church.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that at that time, the army authorities were already aware of my conversion. I tried to keep that secret, but apparently some of my personal friends were informers of the internal security services of Israel, and they passed that information to the authorities. Accordingly, I was posted 34 days in the siege of the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem.
Oh, boy. Okay.
That was a bit too much for me, and a few weeks after that, 4 years ago, the 21st of June 2002, I left Israel for the last time. I left for Asia, and I had in my mind the idea of writing a book, the book that I had finished right now.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, the security services were extremely well aware of my intentions, and they worried. They worried because my inside knowledge of several issues, not only the security issues that I have described now, but issues regarding human rights in Israel.
Yep. Well, let me ask you this. So now, since you left, you saw what was going on around you. It seems to me that knowing that you were a Lutheran, that was going to disqualify you from participating in the oppressive military actions that were being meted out. I have an important question for you, and this is maybe an opinion question on your part. It always has seemed to me that the terrorism that has been perpetrated against Israel has been fomented by Israel. In other words, they need a reason to eliminate the Palestinian population. They need a reason to subjugate them. They need a reason to block them with walls, they need a reason to make victims out of them. So they need terrorism in order to make these things possible. What is your opinion on that?
Any undemocratic regime needs an enemy to keep power.
Yep. Yep.
I cannot tell you from personal knowledge about the things that you are talking about,
mm-hmm.
but I think that I was quite clear. There was a terrorist attack by a single person in Netanya, and
yep.
the answer was to punish a civilian population that had nothing to do with that. In that sense, I think it's one of the pieces in my book
mm-hmm.
that the state of Israel is using this rule of fear in order to control its own population. People have a very strong enemy in front of their eyes. You can't listen to a single news broadcast, and in Israel there are broadcasts every 30 minutes in all the main stations,
yeah,
without having this fear of the Palestinians being pumped into your brain all the time.
Yeah. Well, they've done a similar activities in the American media about terrorism, and they're using the fear of terrorism worldwide and in the United States to change the way Americans are treated under their own constitution. Now, but let's go back to Israel, and because I see parallels to the same fear-mongering and the same controlling ways of control. Your experience when you saw what was happening in these military activities, and you decided that this was immoral, they had already known you were Christian. Did that disqualify you being a Christian from the military completely?
Well, it will make me a security threat. I will not have access to much of the information I had before.
Mm-hmm.
Most probably I will not be called into the reserve service. Christians, in general, are excluded from the Israeli army. You know, and I have touched already that issue, is the issue of discrimination.
Yeah.
I'm sure that most of Americans are not aware of that, but the state of Israel doesn't have a constitution. And that means that the parliament is free to legislate discriminating laws
mm-hmm.
that give different rights and different debts to different citizens based
yep.
on their religious and ethnic origin.
Mm-hmm.
As you can guess, the situation is that people that have a lot of rights, like the Orthodox Jews,
yep.
have very little debt toward the state. And the other case is that the people that have a lot of debt toward the state have very little rights.
Now, let me ask you about a particular group within the state of Israel. It's called the Lubavitch. Are you familiar with the Orthodox Lubavitchers?
The Orthodox Lubavitchers are maybe the most active group trying to proselyze the secular Jews into becoming Orthodox Jews. But you know, it's interesting that you mentioned that, because one of the main theses in my book is that this discrimination adopted by the State of Israel has very, very deep roots within the Pharisaic rabbinical doctrine,
yes.
which the Lubavitchers are part of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a 2,500 years old doctrine adopted in Babylon, which, well, maybe it's not in the scope of such an interview, but...
Well, no, it is in the scope because it's part of, you've been to the website, this is part of our research. So having your take on it is certainly part of this interview.
Okay, so these Orthodox Pharisaic rabbis have a very well interpretation of the Bible. And through the Talmud, which is the tool they have used to give a new interpretation, a new binding interpretation for the Bible, they have transformed all the message there into a message that is based on their own convenience.
So this is rabbinical Talmudic interpretation, not Ten Commandments, not... God's law, but rather interpretive law from rabbinical sources.
It has nothing to do with the Bible. It's all a Talmudic contraption.
Yes.
And you know, maybe I have a very good example. I know I'm not sure if you are aware of a term. It's called Goy Shel Shabbat, or in English it will be Sabbath Goy.
Okay.
Which is extremely interesting concept, rabbinical concept. As you are well aware, the Jews are not allowed to work on Saturday.
Right.
Maybe it's a good law, but it's not a convenient law to the rabbis. That, you know, they wanted to get things done on Saturday. It's not very comfortable if you can't have afford food, if you can't, I don't know, travel to the synagogue, and so on. So they needed to find a more convenient interpretation for them. And what they did was to invent the concept of Sabbatskoi. And that means that maybe it's wrong for you, as a Jew rabbi, to work on Saturday, but it's perfectly good to hire a goy, it means a Gentile, someone who does not belong to the Jewish people,
mm-hmm.
and have him perform your work.
Okay.
You know,
now, I see...
In a sense, this is a very immoral... This is a very immoral thing.
Because it makes people some people get to have the day off while other people have to work.
Yes, maybe a good parallel, it will be, you know, it's in the same list of rules. It's in the Ten Commandments. There is also a commandment saying that you should not kill. It will be like interpreting that I should not kill, but I can hire a foreign person to do that work for me. This is a completely immoral interpretation, and I think that there has been an infiltration of this doctrine from the Pharisaic rabbis to the state of Israel, which nowadays not only discriminates between Jews and non-Jews, Gentiles, but it discriminates also between several classes of Jews.
So could you describe those classes of Jews that there are within Israel itself?
Well, the main categories will be the differentiation between the Orthodox Jews, and that means the practicing Jews, and the secular ones.
Mm-hmm.
The Orthodox Jews are exempted from the army. They can spend all of their lives in yeshivas, which are Jewish colleges, where they can get a scholarship from the state for as long as they are there, and they can stay there until they are 50, 55, 60, all of their life, without any need to prove any gain in the
mm-hmm.
process. You know, it was very difficult for me, after leaving the army, to go to the university. I had no money, I had no scholarship. Despite the fact that I gave 4 years of my life to the state, I put my life in danger to protect that state.
Mm-hmm.
But these people are exempt from the army, get this free scholarship for all of their lives, and they have also other social services benefits that are denied to other parts of the population. Maybe that this is a very broad topic. I invite listeners to.
So, what is the goal of the state in giving these benefits? Are they trying to forward an ideology out of this Orthodox group that is exportable to the United States, or exportable to Europe, or a system that will grow within Israel to become entirely Orthodox? What is the goal here, in your view?
Well, maybe it's not much a goal as a result of the political situation in the country. For much of the last 50 years, there have been a split parliament in Israel. There are two blocks which are approximately the same in size,
mm-hmm.
and none of these groups can reach majority. What happens is that there is a third group, which is the Orthodox parties, which are managed by the leaders of these rabbinical movements, which are those who decide who is the party that will rule the country. That gives them a huge power. It doesn't matter who is the prime minister in Israel. The key element of the coalition is the rabbinical parties.
Yep.
And during the years, they have created two strongholds in the political system. One of them is the Ministry of Interior, which manipulates the internal passport system I will speak about that in a minute. And the second one, is the Committee of Finances in the Parliament. Through the Committee of Finances, they can provide the much-needed budget to operate the big system of yeshivas all around the country. And through the Ministry of Interior, they can manipulate the population.
Yeah.
And how does it done?
Yeah.
I will give you an example, and I find it the most horrorizing example. You know, after I converted to Christianity, I actually cannot get married in Israel.
Okay. How do Christians get married there?
Well, you see, the point is that there are not civil marriages in Israel. All the marriages must be done through religious temples. If you are a Christian, you go to a church. If you are a Jew, you go to a synagogue. It may sound nice, but the problem, the basic problem, is that you cannot decide which one is your religion, because the Ministry of Interior have a list of your parents, and the of everyone's parents, they know the religion, and they will say, if your parents are Christian, you are Christian. If your parents are Jew, you are Jew. That information appears very clearly in the internal passport. It's a document that you must carry at all times when you are in Israel, and it states explicitly if you are Jew, Christian, Muslim, or other.
Okay.
Now, you can tell me, okay, I will go to the Ministry of Interior and I will change my religion. It is good to be a Jew in Israel. I will become Jew.
Well, now, I understand that we here in the United States have to battle this concept of Semitism and anti-Semitism. And what we've been able to understand from our research, Reuven, is that the group that is in control of Israel, by and large, comes from a heritage of an area in the world called Khazaria. And in the 7th century, the king of the Khazars, which he was called a Kagan, invited rabbinical scholars as well as Christian scholars as well as Muslim scholars to come to his kingdom. And he chose a Judaism because not to do that would have placed him and his kingdom on one side of a fight or another. If he had joined the Muslim faith, he would have been fighting the Christians. Had he joined the Christian faith, he'd have been fighting Muslims. So he took a middle road and joined a group that had relationships in both communities. And he converted this group, and this is the beginnings of Ashkenazi Judaism. And there are very few direct ties back to the Babylonian period, except through scripture and tradition. Am I correct in saying that?
Well, the Ashkenazis are by far the main political hold, the main political power in Israel. The main religious parties are led by Ashkenazi rabbis. And you know, an interesting point is that the Oriental, the Sephardic rabbis,
yeah,
most of the yeshivas have adopted the, you know, the Polak clothes of the Ashkenazi ones.
Yes.
You know, maybe it's an attempt by them to become more similar to the ruling class.
Now, are there discriminations between these two groups within Israel?
Well, you know, most of the Sephardim in Israel have been highly discriminated along the years to such an extent that they call themselves the second Israel, meaning
mm-hmm.
that they are second-class citizens within the country.
And what does this mean? They have no equal access to jobs, to promotion, to education, to to housing. What are some of the problems that the Sephardi face?
They have less access to education. They have less access to certain very important units in the army from where the leaders come out. I don't know if you are aware, but Barak and Netanyahu, the two former prime ministers of Israel, came out from the same military unit.
Mm-hmm.
as most of the leaders of Israel, they come out of a very, very small collection of army units.
What about
afterwards, it's more difficult to them to get access to the university, especially to the better, what is considered better, faculties over there. And, you know, at the end of the day, it's more difficult for them to find good jobs.
Mm-hmm. Eric, you have a question?
Yeah, do you have a difference between the Jews that follow the Torah and the Jews that follow the Talmud? Like, we see that division over here in America. Do you have that in Israel also?
Well, you know, the only religious group that accepts, and the Torah is the Pentateuch. The only group, religious group, which accepts the Pentateuch to be the only source of God's inspiration is the Samaritans. The Samaritans is a group that separated from the Jews long time ago and appear in the New Testament. As we all know, the story about the Good Samaritan.
Yes.
Nowadays, there are very little of those left. There are 800 people divided in two communities, one in Holon, south of Tel Aviv, and the second in the Palestinian territories next to Nablus. But beyond them, all of the rabbinical synagogues and yeshivas follow the Talmud, which is their interpretation to the Pentateuch.
Now, there is another group that competes, according to what we understand, but we're not sure, competes with the Lubavitch group, and that is called the Natura Carta. Are you familiar with the Natura Carta and their battle with the Lubavitch and with the Orthodox Torah versus the Talmud?
Well, the Natura Carta are extremely small in Israel. They are living, they have a small community living in the Jewish quarter of the old city of Jerusalem. And they are very famous for rejecting the State of Israel. They claim that the State of Israel has nothing to do with the biblical kingdom of Israel. And they are, in a sense, they have a more mystical interpretation of the Bible, and they claim that they should wait, that Jews should wait until God returns them to the land of Israel and creates the kingdom of Israel.
Now, do you believe that that is more accurate as far as your take on religion is than the one that the others are holding?
Well, as I have told you, I converted to Christianity.
Right, but I mean, as far as the Jews, the Jewish problem of not recognizing each other's beliefs, that belief system is being rejected by and large by the rest of the population, is it not?
Can you repeat that?
Well, the rest of the population of Israel believe that it was okay for the Rothschild family and the Balfour signing and the displacement of Palestinians to rebuild in Palestine. This group of
most of the population in Israel is completely unaware of these issues. And this is because they resent very much the economical benefits that the Orthodox population have, and thus they try to keep away as much as possible from religion.
Ah.
Most of the Jews in Israel are completely secular, and they do not know these issues.
Now, there's another thing that we know. We know that many of the world's criminal enterprises, such as white slavery, such as the pornography industry that is grown in America but has roots in the Middle East, have come from Israel. We know this by the participants, by the money and finances involved, and by the activities that we've observed. And I'm wondering how the country itself can accept this type of behavior. We do understand that in some interpretations within the Talmud, certain things can be considered acceptable. And how does the secular group accept that pornography is being pervaded around the world by by this particular group of people. Do they not know this, or do they know this?
Well, I think that most people in Israel are very aware of the issue of money laundering through the main banks in Israel. It has been widely published in the last years, including a very good article in the BBC. And maybe I will tell you that from a personal point of view. I think that most secular people in Israel believe, wrongly believe, that as long as they are not directly involved in such activities, it's okay. If a corrupted politician is involved in that, it's okay. But if they, but they want to keep distance from that. And maybe the best example I have is when I told that several friends, and it's a sentence that caused me to lose a lot of friends. And I told them, each time you buy a bottle of milk for your kids, you are committing a crime. And you are committing a crime because that bottle of milk includes taxes that goes to a government that doesn't respect any basic human rights in the country or international laws.
That's right. You're absolutely right.
And well, one of my friends, he is very close to the ruling oligarchy. His father is a very important professor. He was an aviator in the Israeli Air Force. His wife is managing a very, very big company in the country. One of my friends heard that from me, and he told me, you should go to jail for saying that. Another friend who belongs to the security services, his father, I don't know if the American public is aware of that, but Israel gained independence from the British after a terrorist attack by the Jews at the King David Hotel.
Yes, by Menachem Begin and the Haganah. Yes, we know this, yeah.
Okay. The person that put the bomb in that hotel is the father of my friend.
Okay.
My friend was recruited when he was very young to the Mossad, apparently as an informer. He served as an art student. I think that you know that term, as an art student in Milan for a while. And nowadays he's in Israel, apparently inactive. He's not conducting any active operations in the sake of the Mossad, beyond the fact that he became an informer on me at a certain point, maybe the peak point in his career. And after I told him that and another similar things, he told me, you know what? In another 30, 40 years, all the people that have stayed here, all the citizens of the country that have stayed here and collaborated with this regime will stand for trial. And maybe this tells the whole story. People are aware of the criminal activities of that government, and they prefer to do nothing, to say nothing.
Well, now, you understand how the structure of the Mossad is a very big part of the society, especially exterior of the country, the activities of the Mossad, and I'm sure recruiting for this particular organization is extensive. Art students seem to be one of their favorite activities in foreign countries. Can you give us an idea of how the Mossad operates in foreign lands in a general sense, not specific, but general sense?
No, the book The Renegade deals quite a lot about that. Right now, I have been 4 years in the run since June 2002. And that gave place to quite a lot of meetings between me and them. I have a lot of stories to tell about that. It will take hours.
Well, give me the most salient and the one that maybe is repeatable throughout the world. I mean, we do know in America that art students have been used. We know that that false flag operations have been done using people dressed as Muslims, but they were in fact Israelis. So we know that, that there are certain types of activities that they repeat in different countries. So maybe you can give us one of your examples, possibly?
They were acting in several angles. Maybe the most simple one were agent provocateurs, that were people coming to me and trying to provoke me into saying certain things, into committing certain crimes. But after a while, you get used to that. It's mm-hmm. very, very easy to shake them off. A more disturbing activity was when they began searching my belongings. Once I caught them doing that, I was in Vientiane, the capital of Laos. I left my hotel room to go to the morning market. In the way, I remember that I forgot to take something I need. I returned to the hotel and they were searching my room. It's not only that they searched, they also stole all kinds of documents. As recently as in Bolivia, they break into my church. I got a sanctuary into a Lutheran church in Bolivia. They broke into my church and they stole several documents that belonged to me.
Mm-hmm.
The third kind of activity is they follow your steps. They see who you are meeting, where are you going. They try to engineer that in all kinds of schemes. But I will keep that short. It's a very long explanation. That the most problematic event that finally led to my recognition as a political refugee by the Republic of Bolivia was the attempt to shoot at me when I entered China, in the town of Qinghong, in southern China, in the province of Yunnan. After they tried very hard a week before that, at least to kidnap me. I'm not sure what was their aim at the previous event. But
how did you thwart their efforts? What was it? Luck? Was it errors on their part? Were they not competent in their work? Or how did you avoid becoming a victim of their activities?
I think the most important issue is that I am an officer in the army there.
I
had their training. I learned in their schools.
Yeah.
I know how they think. And that served me to stay alive.
Yes. Yeah.
You know,
I described a situation to you earlier in our private conversation, and you said, that's about right. I understand the activities of this group as well and their willingness to take risks. I must say, though, that they're not always successful if you expect their activities.
Yes. Once you understand that you are under surveillance, everything becomes much easier for you.
Yes.
Maybe an example for that, six weeks after the assassination attempt in Qinghong, there was an attempt to kidnap me in Buenos Aires. And the only reason I stay alive and free was that I recognized the pattern. I don't know if you are aware, but a few years ago, Israel tried to kill a Palestinian leader in Jordan. It was during the Netanyahu period as prime minister.
Yes.
And it was a very failed attempt. But the details came out, at least in the Israeli media.
Yes. They failed, and they were caught, and in fact it was exposed that the Mossad was active in Jordan.
Yes. Moreover, it was disclosed that they are using biological weapons,
mm-hmm.
because they have injected something in the body of that person that threatened his life. And at that moment, when I was in Buenos Aires, I had all the time a babysitter, someone from the Mossad that was walking actually with me. He was staying in the same guest house I was, and I wasn't allowed to move freely over there. And the, it was the, my last evening in Buenos Aires. He invited me to go to one of the main streets there, La Valle. And when I was there, I discerned the pattern. There were two other people. He was distracting me with conversation. And two other people began walking behind us very rapidly toward us. The technique is then that they inject you, they inject something into your leg, and then to outside lookers, it will look like three friends carrying a drunk. So I saw them coming from behind, and I moved quickly away from them. The next day, in the early morning, I bought a ticket out of Buenos Aires. Finally, that led me to La Paz, Bolivia, where I found a refuge. But the same person that once night before tried to kidnap me invited me to a farewell coffee. And, you know, maybe that was the most difficult moment in the story of my persecution. It wasn't the shooting, you know. When they shoot at you, at least when they shoot at me, I became a soldier, I reacted as a soldier, and I escaped. But this morning was... This morning coffee was more difficult. He took me to a coffee nearby, and he told me more or less, you know what? We like you very much. We like the way you have succeeded escaping us. We are very impressed with your field capabilities. Come and work with us. Join us. And you know, at that point, I had no job. I had less than $100 in my pocket. I knew no one, I knew nobody in that continent. I had nowhere to do, nowhere to go. And I sat there listening to that offer, and maybe there were 1,000 tons over my shoulders. I didn't know what to say.
Yeah.
And after a few minutes, and this is maybe the thing I'm the proudest in the whole of my life, I stood up very slowly and walked away from him. And you know, he looked really surprised. He looked really surprised. I think no one was expecting me to reject their general offer.
Well, you know something, I've got to be honest with you, Reuben. The things that you've shared with us so far in this conversation are not any shock to Eric and I. And I'm speaking for you, Eric. I shouldn't do that, but... We've been involved in uncovering the crimes of this this terribly well ensconced criminal group for a very long time. It seems to me that Israel was set up almost as a way of being extra governmental. In other words, they don't have to answer to anyone. International law is ignored. Domestic law is usurped or it's modified to their needs, and they go around the world almost without resistance to further a doctrine of supremacy. And I'm wondering if you have any insights on how we, as non-Jews, can fight back against this coming supremacy that they've got planned for us.
You know, maybe it's my time to ask a question.
Yeah.
And maybe it will be a very tough one.
Yep.
You know, American people have a very, very beautiful constitution. You know?
Yep.
It provides equal rights to all the citizens, regardless the gender, religion, ethnic group. And, you know, as far as I don't know, I come from a country that doesn't have a constitution. Israel doesn't have a constitution. So I'm not an expert in these issues. But as far as I understand, a constitution is a kind of basic law that states the most basic principles upon which the country should be run. So if the principles of the American people are based on the noble ideas of equality among men, how is that you are giving $6 billion to every year to a country that doesn't have a constitution and does not respect the most basic human rights of its citizens?
Well, you see, now here's what you need to know about America. at the very highest level all the way to the mid-level of our government, that we are entirely and completely controlled by Zionist interests. That is the war and the battle cry that Eric and myself and many others across the United States are fighting today. We know that people like Dov Zolkheim and people like Paul Wolfowitz and people like Richard Pearl and people like the Miller family, the Simon family, the families across the Kahns, the Loebs, the Schiffs. We know these families have supremacy in their plans for us, and they have usurped our Constitution, Reuven. Our Constitution has been left floundering as we speak, and no longer are we protected against these things that you have said. We've had our elections stolen by them. We've had our laws completely ignored by the leadership. And so the fact is, a constitution is only as good as the people willing to try to enforce it. And because today America's constitution is resting unenforced, and our legal system is controlled also by Zionist interests, we are in a situation right now where the country itself is falling apart around us. We're heading toward tyranny in the United States, Reuven.
That's very sad.
It is very sad, and it is the reason why I have become so deeply involved in this, because for me, I cannot live in tyranny. It is impossible for me to accept tyranny as my future. And so I'm forced by my beliefs to do whatever I can to stop it. Now, Eric, you've probably got a few questions for Reuven. I know we've been talking a long time. Eric, do you have a few things you'd like to ask Reuven?
Well, I was wondering also, when you said 30 families are running Israel's business, what exactly would you say these families are? Are they working together for the state of Israel? Are they just independent people? Are they controlling the banking system also, the media? Are they influencing the government? Because over here in America, some of these wealthy families like the Millers and the Simons, they're influencing who gets elected. Some of them are buying up newspapers, magazines, television stations. They're not just businessmen. They are trying to get control of this country. And are you seeing the same thing going on in Israel, a small handful of people grabbing control?
Well, you know, analyzing the oligarchy there will take a while. Maybe I will give you only two examples. The media, the newspapers are being controlled by three families. One of the families is very famous for being armed brokers. And the editor of the main editor of that newspaper was in jail for a while for attempting to kill someone. But these are better stories. The one that I was very close was to the oligarchy in the chemical industry. And over there are two families controlling all the market. And I was very close to one of them, the Jacobson family. I was so close, I spent 2-3 hours a day with the head of the family and the company. And I witnessed how many of the chemical businesses in Israel were operated. One of the better examples I have is that one of the main industries in the south, in Be'er Sheva, where all the main chemical industry supporting the nuclear program of Israel is based, made an annual bid for certain products. And there were two participators in that bid. One was the Jacobson family. The second one was the other family. And I participated in the negotiations, and at a given point it was very clear to all of us working in the Jacobson agency that we were going to lose that year, the bid. And I was very naive at the time, and I was still taking my MBA courses. One of them was about negotiations. And I talked with Ram Jacobson, the head of the family, and I told him, you know, maybe we could adopt a different approach to the negotiation. And I offered him a few ideas. And he sat there chewing his expensive cigar and smiling at me. And at the end of my excited talk, he told me, "Don't worry, it's not our turn to win this year."
So it was a sham negotiation from the start.
Yes, it was a kind of game between those families which share the market. One year one wins, the other year the second wins.
What is the view of the Israeli public of America? Are you familiar with the APEC, with the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee, or the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith, or the B'nai B'rith International? Or are you familiar with these organizations?
These organizations are well known in Israel and appear regularly in the newspaper articles.
Well, they are the ones who have, by and large, bought America's controlling families, and they are involved at the very highest and lowest levels, and I say lowest intentionally, because the protection that goes on through these organizations, the intimidation, the control of our politicians is amazing. One of the main ways of controlling our politicians is first finding someone who can be compromised, compromising that person either with drugs or with embezzlement or with pedophilia or sex or prostitution, and then once they own that politician, they promote him to a higher level. And this has been their modus operandi for controlling certain elements within the United States government. And it's virtually controlled, thoroughly controlled by this group, by these means. Now, they use the means that are best suited to each individual politician, but almost to a man, the top leadership of America is owned and operated by the B'nai B'rith and ADL and APEC.
Well, you see, most of the Israeli people are very aware that their well-being depends heavily on the annual contribution of money by the United States. You know, every child, woman, man in the United States contributes every year $20 to the state of Israel through this organized help by your state. And along the years, I think this is going at least for some 25 years, this help is formed the state of Israel from a third world country into one in which at least the Jewish population lives in a first world level.
Well, you know, the items that the things we've discussed today, that we've gone through so many subjects, and I don't want to stay too long on one straight talk here. I would want to have you back, Reuven, because if you'll acquiesce to speaking with us one more time, maybe we could develop some more information. I tried as best I could to respect your guidelines to this. I hope I've done my part. I believe you've done a very good job of explaining the things you've tried to explain. So it's going to be an important interview because many people know this information, but they've never heard someone with first-person knowledge explain it in such a way. Eric, do you have anything to add to this?
Well, I was just wondering if, now that you're in America, are you still concerned that the Mossad is going to be causing trouble? Do you feel that they have, like, free access within America to bother you, or do you feel protected here?
I won't be very explicit. I don't feel very protected here.
So you feel that they can pretty much do as they please within this country, even though they're a foreign government and they really have no right here?
I don't feel safe here.
Okay. Well, I understand that. I don't feel safe here in France either, to be honest with you. Look,
I'm sorry, I don't want to go into details.
No, you don't need to. I understand exactly where you're coming from because I'm feeling the same kinds of pressures here in France. And look, this was very enlightening in many, many ways, Reuven. And I've got to tell you, you need to get several additional copies of that manuscript and put them everywhere, regardless, in case something happens to some of your originals, you have it out already out in the world, and so that it could not be destroyed or eliminated, you know, because that is a possibility.
It's a possibility. I'm very aware of that.
Well, okay. I just thought it was a good bit of advice because, you know, the files that we've done here on the French Connection are everywhere in the world. They will never be extinguished. They're in tens of thousands of different people's hands. And this truth will live on well beyond our years and will go out into the future, educating people about these dangers. And I want to thank you deeply for taking the time and having the courage to share this stuff with us. Eric, do you have anything to say parting to Reuven?
Well, no, but I guess other than, you know, take a look at what we've got on the website, because you might find there's a whole lot more that you never picked up in Israel, like with 9/11, and, you know, open your eyes to some of that stuff. That you might find that interesting.
There's a lot there, Reuven, as I told you, that will, you know, in Israel, you would not be privy to some of this information because, as you are well aware, much of this is filtered out of your press and out of your purview. So my idea is that you might find a great deal to inform you about the way the world is actually working. And I think we've got some things to actually help you to even understand better this conspiracy.
You can be sure I will be looking at that.
Well, thank you, sir, again, and I appreciate it very much for you taking the time on the French Connection. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank Reuven from the bottom of my heart, and I want to thank you all for being here with us today. And, Eric, thank you for participating in this. Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Daryl Bradford Smith, and this is the Thursday edition of the French Connection. I want to thank you all for being here with me, and bye-bye. Be well.